All right, thank you so much. My name is Mayan Corioso. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic. By God's grace, I've had the gift of sobriety since December 17th of 08. For that, I'm very, very grateful. And so is the state of Texas. I think they just got tired of locking me up. So it's just an honor to be here. You know, I've been on quarantine for the last 2 weeks. I got exposed to somebody who had COVID. And so they locked me in my house for 2 weeks. And I'm a little stir crazy, so really cool to be able to hang out with some drunks on Zoom and talk about the miracle of this program. I think we all have a responsibility to carry this message and to be armed with the facts of ourselves and to be real clear about what qualifies us to be here. And more importantly, I think we're all bound with this responsibility to bear witness to God's love and God's power and his way of life. And that's my goal tonight. I want to talk about what I was like, what happened and what I was like, what I'm like now. You know, I was reflecting as I was kind of getting ready for this deal, just the stark contrast of what my world looked like 13 years ago. And the despair I was in and the fear that I carried along with me and the shame and all the legal trouble that I had, which doesn't qualify me to be here, but it was my story. And it's a truly a miracle. I've got a house full of kids. One of them may run in here. You never know. And a wife that likes to be around me. And it's just like I said, I am eternally indebted to Alcoholics Anonymous. And more importantly, what I gained from here, there's a fellowship of folks that I was missing my whole life. I would walk into a room and always feel like I was different. And when I was introduced to you guys years ago, I instantly felt at home. But most importantly, what I have is a relationship with God and with my Creator that's remarkable. And the things that I think people say it all the time, but you know, when we first come in, I just don't want to get evicted. I want to stay out of jail. I want to have a relationship. All those types of things that we think we're looking for. And the things that come, as it says on page 100, the things that come when we avail our lives to this power, when we give our lives fully to this power, it's truly a miracle. So I'll jump into it. Frank, I appreciate the introduction. It's just an honor to, I think I spoke to about 10 guys that I work with today, starting at 8 o'clock this morning, throughout the day. And God just gives me an opportunity and just an honor to walk guys through the work and be able to continue to give this thing away. Again, thank you so much for having me. I was born in San Jose, California, and I live here in Dallas, but I was born in 1983 in San Jose, California, which the 80s was like the heyday of the 49ers Super Bowl. So I'm not a Cowboy fan. I just want to make that clear for you Mississippi folks. I'm not a big Cowboy guy. I'm from the Bay Area. My mother was homeless. She was the first name I put on my four-step list. She was the first resentment. I went to countless hours of therapy over her. And through this process of forgiveness, through this process of the steps and really seeing some truths about my life and other people's lives. What I realized today is my mother, who bounced around from house to house, who left me often by myself as a young child. She did the best she could with what she had. And I can say that completely honestly today. And that's just as a result of these steps, but it's my truth. I went to foster care. I was in foster care for a couple of years, and I went to multiple homes, and was finally adopted by a wonderful family in California. And you just see, it's amazing when we're in our, and it, I'm not talking, when I talk about the disease of alcoholism is a two-part illness. And I want to dive into this stuff, and I want to tell my story in light of the steps. I want to take us on a journey of the steps and qualify myself and hopefully quickly talk about the solution, because that's what this thing is about. But when we're in our spiritual malady, it's amazing how we will look through our lives with the self-pity that Bill talks about, the fear, the remorse, and the shame, and all that stuff. And I can look at a situation and feel like I was a victim. And I was a victim for many, many years. And I remember before I came into the rooms, I would talk about my past, my upbringing and my past and being adopted and all those challenges with that. When I look at it today with a new pair of glasses, with God in the middle of this whole thing, when I look at my life today, what I realized was God was always there, and I was just blessed, and I was adopted by a wonderful family. My father was military. Most of my family was military on both sides of the family. So I was kind of raised in that military mindset. I had my parents desperately wanted to be parents. They couldn't have kids, and they adopted me, and they adopted my sister when she was, when I was 5 years old. And, we were a happy family. I should be careful. There's a lot of Dallas folks on here, but one of the low points in my life was when my dad's job got transferred to Dallas, Texas. And I didn't know anything about Dallas, Texas, except folks wore cowboy hats and talk weird. But I remember all my family was in California, and we moved out here to Dallas. And I don't know if this is a thing anymore. I was born in 83. So you can kind of, where I was raised in it with different sets of values. But do they do chores these days? I don't know if kids do chores. Well, I did chores, and I did chores not to get paid, because I hear kids get paid these days. We would do chores because if you want to live under this house, like under this roof, you're going to have to do some work, right? And that was the mentality that I was raised with. But I remember when I was 14 years old, I was an athlete. I played baseball. That was my sport. I think when I came to my parents in foster care, I came with a baseball bat and a glove and a pair of a change of clothes, and that was it. So sports was like a big part of my deal. My father, again, I was 14. He was an adult. I think at 14 we're pretty rebellious. But one of my chores was to do mow the grass. And so I remember 14 years old, right? Procrastination was my thing. I said, well, I'll just do it later when it cools off. We were just talking about the weather. It gets pretty hot here in Texas, in Dallas, in August is when it was. It was, 100 degrees. And so really the truth was I wanted to go to the mall and hang out with some girls, and that was the truth. And so I just had some new shoes, and I get my shoes on, and I get ready to go, and I hear the lawnmower start. And I don't know about how you were raised, but that is not good in my house. Like if that's happening, it means that you're in trouble. They're going to do the job for you, but you're going to get either a lecture or some sort of physical altercation may take place. And so my mom looked at me, and I looked at her, and she gave me that look like, you better get out there. And I was like, okay. So I kind of rushed out there, and I looked at my father, and I'm just waiting for the lecture and all that. And I ran over there, and he's looking at me with, those. And it's crazy, because now that I am a parent, you just understand all of it. I do the same stuff to my kids, and it's so cool how it comes full circle. But I remember him looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and we're staring each other down and kind of waiting and waiting and waiting. And he stopped the lawnmower, and I'm like, uh-oh, this is not good. So he stops the lawnmower and looks back at me, and all I can remember is hearing a very loud thud, and what that noise was his forehead hitting the concrete, and I didn't know what to do, so I ran and got my mother, and we called 911, and I want to share this story because it's very, very important when it comes to me, when I come to you guys and you tell me I have to develop a relationship with God. I was 14 years old, and this is when my relationship with God kind of went sour. And so when I came to the program, I had a 14-year-old concept of God. And what happened was I'm dialing 911, and I hit my knees, and I'm begging God. I'm saying, do this. Please save my father. Something's wrong. And I'm doing everything I know to do, right? And we make it to the hospital, and it was like it was just yesterday, and it was, you know, years ago. The doctor comes in and says my father had passed away, and I remember he had a massive heart attack, and I remember feeling guilt and shame that he was doing a job that I was supposed to do, and all the stuff that we go through. But more importantly, what I remembered was that God wasn't there for me, and I was going to have to take care of myself, and I did that. And high school was a 14-year-old without a father, and there's, you know, trying to navigate the waters of high school. Luckily, sports was really instrumental in kind of keeping me out of some crazy times. But I will never forget that first time, and the first time I had a drink and really got drunk. I was 16, 17 years old. I went to a party. And it was one of those deals where you tell that your friend that you're staying, you tell your parents that you're staying at that friend's house. They tell, you know, we all kind of just, and we had a party and someone handed me a beer. I don't know if this was normal. I know the book talks about the progression of the disease of alcoholism, and you may start out as a normal drinker. When I was handed that beer, I downed it. I drank it like quickly, and it entered into my system and did something, to my body physically, but also to my mind and my emotions, and I was instantly in love with the feeling that I had experienced, the sense of ease and comfort. I could remember the spiritual malady being alive and well in me at 3 years old. I remember the fear that I carried along and never feeling like I belonged. And I remember taking that drink and feeling like I was somebody. And I did not go on a bender. I did get drunk. Someone handed me a cigar, we used to smoke these Black and Milds in the neighborhood that I grew up in. And it wasn't a cigar. It was something else. And so I did all that stuff in the same night. And it was just a crazy night, but I didn't go crazy after that. I did get an opportunity to play college baseball, and I was quickly introduced to this art form. They call it binge drinking, college binge drinking. I was a freshman and I actually got to start as a freshman on a team that was pretty good. We were ranked third in the nation at the time, and I remember the night before the first game, I was so nervous because I'd always wanted to play college baseball, and the night before the first game, the seniors called me and said, hey, come down to our place. We're gonna have a keg party. And I thought that was weird that you would have a keg party before a game. I thought that was odd, but they said, no, we do that. And we do it before every game until we lose. Well, we ended up going 28-0 that year. I think we lost only three games the whole year. So I think we ended up 33-3. But the first 28 games, we were undefeated. So I quickly became introduced to this drinking game. The consequences were pretty minuscule at first. You know, I would maybe not oversleep and not go to class. I was ruining relationships, those types of things. This disease of alcoholism quickly progressed to me. Within a matter of a couple of years. And so by 21, I was a full-blown alcoholic. And what does that mean? And I want to talk about that because we hear people talk about, throw that term out, and what does it mean to be an alcoholic? Well, what do, I just drink every day. Well, that doesn't necessarily make me an alcoholic. And the book talks about me being powerless over alcohol and my life being unmanageable and what that, what it looked like. And I can sum this thing up in step one like this. I got an opportunity to play. I remember going on a pretty prodigious bender, and my mother came and picked me up, the sweet Al-Anon she is, and took me back home. And she said, "Well, what do we do?" And so we went and got a therapist, and we go see the therapist. And I mean, it's starting to look real bad, right? Externally, I can't function. It's starting to get bad. I got some outside issues going on. And we go to a therapist, and the therapist proceeds to tell me how, because of my childhood, that's why I'm drinking. And she goes on and on about how all these things, and I think she cried at one point in our session, and if I can just play professional baseball, which was my lifelong dream, I will stop drinking. And I was thinking, Mom, we got to pay this lady extra. I love this lady, you know, and she's talking about how my mom needs to be easier on me and all this stuff. And I just love it. Right. And so I go do what she told me to do. I went and signed a professional contract and had an opportunity to play professionally. And the book says that we emerge remorseful with a firm resolution never to do this again. On page 24, it talks about a week or a month before that insane thought, right? I can't bring into consciousness with sufficient force the memory and suffering of even a week or a month ago. And so I have a firm resolution, and if I'm a heavy drinker, I will stick to that resolution. If I was a heavy drinker, I go to the therapist. She tells me I need to play professional baseball. You wouldn't be talking to me right now if I wasn't the real deal alcoholic. But I signed this professional contract, and this is what qualifies me, okay? I signed this contract, and I remember kind of feeling restless, irritable, and discontented. I had just had surgery on my shoulder, and so I was kind of out of shape, and I wasn't getting the playing time I wanted. Really, I wasn't good enough to be at that level, but pretty delusional. I remember going to Hooters. We went to Hooters one night, and mind you, I've got everything externally that I wanted, right? I get all my ducks in a row, and then I go duck hunting, and what it looks like is this. I'm going to Hooters, and I'm hanging out with the guy. I have this firm resolution, never going to happen again. I'm never going to drink again. I'm not going to go down this road again. I swear to my mother, she's crying. She's looking at, you know, you can't do this to me anymore. Don't you love me? And my mother is someone who was very instrumental. When I was adopted, I was very introverted. I was very wounded by a lot of different things that had happened. And I didn't talk to anybody. And my mother, we had a connection. She would sit and read with me. She taught me how to read. She taught me how to speak. I couldn't really talk to people. And so we were close, and you could just see the shame in my mother's eyes. And I think we can all kind of relate to that. And if you have a spouse or somebody that cares about us, that thinks it's their, they play a part in this thing, and they it's their fault. But when I make that firm resolution to my sweet mother, I do love her. I am telling the truth. I don't want to do the things that I'm doing. I don't want to be dishonest. I don't want to steal money out of the account. But I go to Hooters after about a week or a month with no solution. And this internal condition is just eating my lunch. I'm walking around with 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. And I can't stop from thinking, why can't I drink like them? My buddies could drink. They would go to sleep. They would wake up and go to practice the next day. And the book says that we see others taking drinks with impunity, which means that they don't have the same consequences that I have. They can take drinks with impunity. But I don't have impunity. I'm not protected from these consequences. So I take the same drinks that they take. It triggers an allergy in my body. I just wanted to do what they were going to do, just have two or three, go to bed, wake up, go to practice. It triggers this allergy. I go off on a spree. I take shots after shot. I come to a week later at a place where you get outside issues with somebody in my car that I had no clue who it was. A week later, we had practice the next day, and I come to a week later. Needless to say, I'm no longer employed by that team and never made it back. Never played again. I wake up with the shame, guilt, remorse, and all that stuff. You give me another week and or a month later, and I'm doing the same things over and over again. I'm drinking. This time I take 15 shots of Jaeger. We call it Jaeger bomb, where you mix Jaeger and Red Bull. Anyway, triggers the allergy. I'm off for the races. I need more. My friend's ready to go home. I'm not ready to go home. I steal his keys, steal his car, and drive 100 miles an hour in a residential neighborhood, and get pulled over by the police. And they ask me what's going on, and I tell them I'm having an allergic reaction, which was true, and I needed to get my medicine, which was true. I just didn't know it yet. I didn't understand what made me an alcoholic. I leave jail. Truly, someone who was pretty straight-laced in high school and fairly didn't really get detentions or get in trouble. I leave jail pretty beat up and with a firm resolution never to do it again. And that was May 13th of 2007. And by July 11th, 2007, I'm drinking again in a bar. I get behind the wheel and I get arrested. By August, again, I'm drinking, it triggers the allergy. See, I'm a blackout drinker. I'm a blackout at this time. I can't control the amount I take. And so I am a logical person. I'm pretty educated. I understand that I need to stop doing this. I understand that I need to stop getting drunk and driving and all that stuff, but I don't have the power. I'm powerless over what alcohol does to me. And so again, you go on a couple sprees like that, and you end up in a place called treatment. I was hearing voices. The voices are real. The DT voices, man. I was answering the voices. I was in a court. I was in a court hearing something or other, and I was answering the voices. And so they don't really they send you to hospitals for that. And I went to a treatment center, and for the first time, was introduced to a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Someone came in and talked about this allergy piece, and I was really clear about this thing. I 100% understood that I could not drink. I could not safely drink. What I did not truly get was this mental piece. But they talked about the allergy piece and how I'm an alcoholic and alcohol doesn't process in my body the same way as it does 90% of the other population. My friends, the reason why they don't have the same consequences or the same issues is because alcohol is not doing the same thing in their bodies. They may go, they may want to go get drunk, but they're calling their numbers. They're able to call their numbers. I have no choice once I start. I leave treatment again with some knowledge. I love Bill's story because he talks about the first time he was introduced to Dr. Silkworth, and he left treatment with like the goose hung high. Like he had some self-knowledge and he felt like he had some, so he was going to be able to lick this thing. I remember going out with some buddies of mine, a good friend of mine who played for the Denver Broncos, and it was my birthday. It was the 14th of January. I left treatment in November, so I was a couple months sober. It was my birthday, and he's like, "Hey dude, you got to take a shot. It's your birthday." And I had zero defense over that. And I took the shot. And then, so the whole year of pretty much the whole year of 2008, I'm being convinced, because most of us don't like to be convinced, not of the physical piece. I think a lot of us understand the physical piece. It's this mental aspect of it. It's this idea that stone cold sober, I'm going to make a decision that's probably going to kill me. I cannot keep myself sober. An example of that, quick example of that, is that I've got some time. I go through this cycle where it's a 3 month, I'm a chronic relapser. Every 3 months I get a new desire chip and I come back and I kind of bounce around from group to group because you don't really want the same people to know that you're relapsing. So you just kind of like drift around. So I don't think anybody can relate to that, but it was my truth. I remember having 5 months of sobriety and really wanting to stay sober, but not really wanting to have to do everything that's suggested in the program. I love half measures. I wish that half measures worked. If half measures worked, again, you wouldn't see me tonight. I just wanted to kind of come in, get the heat off, maybe make a couple friends here and there, but not really have to dive into this work. What I wasn't clear about was that I have zero defense. And I remember being 5 months sober and driving to this gas station and looking into the gas station and I had been in this gas station the prior 5 months multiple times, and I recognized that there's a neon light that I didn't notice before. And underneath that neon light was alcohol. It was beer. They sold beer at this gas station. I remember wrestling with this obsession, this lurking notion, right? I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do it. I remember taking a coin out, said, okay, we'll leave it up to chance. And I remember flipping the coin and I told myself, if it lands on heads, I will go home. If it lands on tails, I'm going to go drink. And I flipped the coin once and it landed on heads. I took it again. I flipped it again. And it landed on heads again. I flipped it 20 times and it landed on heads all 20 times. And I threw the coin out the window and I went and drank. I have zero defense. I have zero defense. That's what the obsession looks like in me. The palms are sweating. I'm constantly obsessing. And I remember going and relapsing and coming back in with a full understanding, full knowledge of what was wrong with me. And really understanding that I needed to get some power in me. I needed to get connected to this power quickly. And I needed to do what was suggested. And so I called my sponsor and we got to work. And it was crazy because the obsession was lifted very quickly. I got well pretty quickly. I remember my 1 year sobriety date, I graduated college, which was something I never thought I could do. It was so cool. And the family's crying and I'm crying. It was just like, man, this powerful moment that I did something with God, right? The first year of my sobriety, you know, it was like this whole, I think that first year, it's a tough journey because you're learning how to surrender. You're learning how to live life and you work through some steps and you have some cool experiences, but there's some real life stuff that starts to happen and you realize you can do anything with this power. And I remember that step two was not very hard. Step three was not very challenging. I remember getting to step four and doing some inventory. And like I told you before, my mother was on the list. I had folks that, I remember having a situation happen to me, and I'm not trying to stir up anything because there's a lot of stuff going on right now. And it's so sad what's going on in our world, because if you could have the experience that I had with these steps, when I was 12 years old, I remember going, my sister was Caucasian. She's my adopted sister. She's Caucasian. And I'm, you know, obviously I'm of color. And, I remember going over to her friend's house to pick her up. And I remember this lady, her friend's mother opens the door and was like, hey, I don't allow people of your color on my property. And I remember not really understanding that, because from where I'm from in California, it's not really an issue. Everybody was kind of something. And so I remember kind of being confused by it, but holding on to that resentment. And I would tell you this stuff, that those first two columns that we do in step four, I would talk about those first two columns at the bar, right? You wouldn't believe the amount of racism, this and that. And what I realized when I did a fifth step and really dove deep into this work was, in eighth grade, there was a gentleman in my class, and it always gets me emotional thinking about this because it's the truth. And again, the reason why I think the book talks about us resentment being the number one offender is because I'm blocked off at seeing some truth about my shame, about the way I've acted, the way I've treated people. I'm unable to see that. All I see, the self-delusion, is I'm a victim, I'm a victim, I'm a victim. Well, victims get drunk. And so in order to move forward, I was going to have to see some truths about me. And some truth is that in eighth grade, there's a gentleman who had some mental illness issues in my class, and he would do some all kinds of, I think he had Tourette's or something. And I'm not knocking it because, you know, I had to clean some of the stuff up, but he would say things and just do things. And we would all, me and some other friends who were of color, we would just make fun of this kid all the time. So much so that I remember this kid's putting his desk in the back of the classroom. And I remember going through this work and finding some truths, and remember how all I could think about was how bad I felt when I was 12 years old and that lady said what she said to me. But I remember, I wonder how this kid felt every single day he had to show up to school. And the truth was I did the same thing that that lady did. I treated people who were different than me badly. My ego, I had such low self-esteem, so full of fear that I had to attack other people's weaknesses, things that I couldn't control in order to feel superior about myself. And that revolutionized the way I looked at the world and looked at some of these things that came up. You know, step 6 and 7 are, there's some major stuff specifically around my sex inventory, how I treated women and how I treated people. It caused a lot of shame and what we have to do. And I think it's important for us to really understand that we've got to get God in the middle of this whole thing. That I can't try to fix self-will with self-will. And a lot of people, and I did this, I was definitely one of these people where we come into AA and we try to get good. I try to just act good, right? And what 6 and 7, if you really read that 7-step prayer, it talks about, you know, give me powers as I go out here to do your bidding. And so the decision that I made in step 3 was God, save my bacon, and I'm going to go help your kids. And the deal I made with God was I'm going to do his work, stay close to him, and he's going to take care of everything else. And so my job is to go help his kids as much as possible. God's going to fix this stuff over time. And some of this 6 and 7 stuff is taking years to overcome, financial stuff, lots of defects that have taken years. I don't know what God's going to use and not use. And my job is just to go out here and do his work. I love this stuff. And I think it's applicable as we're doing the work, especially if I'm new in sobriety, right? Because sometimes it's hard. I had a lot of financial issues going on. I had a lot of legal stuff I had to face. It's hard to see the gratitude. You know, it's hard to see God working in some of this stuff. And for the first time, I stopped running from my problems, right? I'm starting to face some stuff. And I love this stuff. Cliff Bishop, who is the founder of our group, I'm from the Primary Purpose Group of Dallas. I didn't introduce that, but Cliff Bishop used to say, you know, if you wake up sober, you've been paid for that day. And so your job is to go earn your pay. And so if I wake up sober, my job is to go do God's work. There's some powerful experiences that I had through making these amends. I had to face my some folks that I've harmed. And one particular situation came up when I was a couple years sober. And if we give this thing a chance, and there's signs on AA rooms, don't leave before the miracle happens. And my answer to that is, which one? I mean, there's just so many opportunities that we get to, if we allow God to run the show. So many cool things happen. I told you about the first name I had on my 4-step inventory, the resentment I had towards my mother, my biological mother. I believe that she gave me up for adoption, but I think there is some CPS stuff going on. She would leave for days at a time and not come back. And I would just sit in my crib and cry. And it was just a therapist, a dream, right? Where you talk about the inner child and all this stuff. None of that stuff had anything to do with me being an alcoholic. It had nothing to do with it. it may have exasperated some of the stuff. I may have drank over some of the stuff, but I'm an alcoholic because I can't control what alcohol does to me, and I can't manage the decision to stay stopped, period. And the reason why I say that is because my sister went through the same stuff, the trauma, the death, abandonment issues, and she's not an alcoholic. I got an email from a lady that said, I am your biological mother, and I would like to meet with you. I've got some health stuff going on, and I wanted to reconnect with you. And my first reaction was kind of going off that resentment list, and like, I wonder who this is. She's probably just looking for something. And then I called my sponsor and we talked about it and thought it would be a good idea to go see her. And so I remember going to visit her, and she let me in some information that I had a biological brother that she had given up for adoption as well, and that he was coming too. And so I go to San Jose. She still lives in San Jose in the same house that I lived in with her. And we went and visited her, and it was just an amazing experience. I got to see, first of all, what we have to do in these steps. And I think it happens right around 8 and 9 and 5 and, you know, 6 and 7 is we have to forgive everybody of everything. We have to. I will not be free. I may not have a part, but I will not be free unless I forgive everybody of everything. And so what I was able to do was forgive my mother. And the book talks about resentments and fears too, fancied or real, which means that I am delusional about some of this stuff, which means I may not know the whole story. And she told me the story, and I didn't know this story. I had a story in my mind. I had some people that had some information. And this is the story. She was bipolar, schizophrenic, and she desperately wanted, she had my brother, and she had to give him up for adoption, and she desperately wanted to be a mother. And so she tried to keep me for a couple of years. She tried to be my mother, and she looked me in my eyes and said, "Mine, I have a disease that I'm just not proud of, that when I don't take my medication, when it goes untreated, I do things that I regret, and I know I hurt you, and I hope there's something I can do to make that right, and I hope you'll forgive me." And how could I not forgive this woman? Because I have a disease that made me do things that I regret. And when I go, when my disease goes untreated, I do some things that I just am not proud of. And there are people that I had to go say the same thing to. And so I was finally able to let her in. I was finally able to let her go with the truth. And what I found out was my brother, my biological brother, who was adopted by a different family and was raised in a different family, was also, he's 13 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and had very similar experiences. And it was amazing because you sit in a room with a bunch of non-alcoholics, and then you got two folks who are alcoholics, and we're telling war stories. And he was telling me his story, and he was said, "Ben," he goes, "one time I had relapsed." He was a chronic relapser just like me. And he said, "I relapsed and I didn't have money to go to treatment." And so my best idea was I went to a cop and told the cop to take me to treatment. And he told me to, you know, get the heck out of here. So I just punched him. And he said, I got tased about 4 times. And as my head was hitting the pavement and blood was spewing out of my forehead, I realized that I was powerless over alcohol. My life was in. I realized I needed to get a power greater than myself in my life, or something was going to change. And I'm laughing. I just think this is hilarious. And that's my story. I get that. And everybody else is looking at us like we're crazy. But again, without this program, without you guys, I would never, these two individuals are in my life, and my kids call her grandma, and my brother and I got to go to some meetings out there in the West Coast, and we keep in contact, and it's just an amazing deal, the miracles that continue to happen. I want to quickly run through 10, 11, and 12, because I think step 10 is a step that kind of gets overlooked, and But it was a step that is so vital for me and a step that I think when we get to like year five and I'm driving the Lexus and I've got the wife and I've got the cool job and I think everybody goes through it, right? We all go through these periods, and I'm not unique in this, where it's like my growth has stopped. A lot of it had to do with this confusion around step 10, and we get this profound humility and peace and connection with our higher power when we do this fifth step. And then we kind of get into this stage where we feel like we don't need to do it anymore, right? And the 10th step is so powerful because and I stopped doing the 10th step and my prayer life was a wreck, and I stopped doing the 12th step, and I got really sick really quickly. And my defects of character are starting to show back up, and I'm doing things that I don't even know if I would have been doing them when I was drinking. And I'm violating spiritual principles in my marriage. But I'm sober, right? And everybody says that. And I'm about as sick as you can be because I have nowhere to run. I'm twisted up. I'm thinking about suicide. That's becoming that's becoming something that's on the table. And I got in touch with these cats at a group, and they said, you need to go see these guys over here at this primary purpose group. And what we do is we study the basic text. We get back to the foundation of what this thing is all about. I got into all kinds of other crazy stuff, and I lost my truth. I wasn't really clear what made me an alcoholic, because I think if we're clear of that, we will treat this thing every single day. I can be recovered, but what I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. When do I need to pray? I need to pray every day that I want to live. If I'm clear about that, if I'm clear about my step one truth, I will do this thing like my life depends upon it, specifically around this step 10 stuff. When I start doing step 10, I get back into 10, 11, and 12, and my life changes. The one thing that I think was missing in my life, and it says it in the book, that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking like intensive work with other alcoholics. I didn't understand what I had. There's a story I love to tell when it comes to the 12th step. And there was when Bill was trying to spread the message, he wrote the book, and he's trying to open groups in different areas. He goes out to California and he hears about this guy that was drinking himself to death in his cellar. And his mother had reached out to Bill and said, "Hey, I got my son is dying. I've locked him up in the fruit cellar, and I need you to come see him. I need you to come right now." And so Bill's like, "I'll be right there." And so Bill drops everything and he rushes over there. And this guy named Maxwell, he talks about the story. He says it was in this cellar, this fruit cellar. It was pitch black. And he looks up because he hears some commotion outside the cellar, and Bill Wilson is opening the door of the cellar and reaching his hand into the cellar. And all he could see was light and Bill Wilson's hand reaching in, and Bill pulled him from the darkness into the light. And he stayed sober ever since. He worked these steps and was transformed by this beautiful program. That is the power that I have that I was unwilling to do, because I had a good job and I have a cool, I have everything I need. The arrogance I had at 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years sober, the arrogance I had, realizing that God has given me a gift. I'm armed with some truths that nobody else has. I am qualified when doctors and therapists and judges can't help, and desperate wives, I'm the one that has the solution. And somebody needs to hear from me, my story, the way I tell it. And I know I can venture to say that there's somebody on this call, that there's somebody out there that needs to hear from you and the way that you the experiences that you've gone through. And if we're sitting on our rear ends, going to meetings and just not drinking one day at a time, we're robbing someone of the miracle, someone in the darkness that needs to be pulled into the light. And that's what the step 12 means to me. I sponsor a whole bunch of guys. I have the honor and the pleasure to do that. I think because I'm pretty sick. I mean, I think God's blessed me with some guys that I may have helped them, but they helped me more, like Frank, and I think Peyton's on this call, and a couple other folks that I just have the honor today. That which I thought was such a was so cumbersome, and our program is sometimes, but it's amazing. It is amazing, and it's not about the external, the financial stuff. I think we just kind of go through some of that stuff. But as we get evidence of this power, as we grow in this program, as we continue to be shown nuggets of truth around God working in our lives, it becomes more abundantly clear that my faith, because I think in step two, it's all about hope. And through me working this program, it turns into faith as I have life experiences. The only way for me to get faith is through the experience. And the only way that I get this experience is to take some action. And so I've got a commitment today, every week, a couple of commitments that I do. I've got a home group that I love. And I've got, I don't know if you guys know Myers. I don't know if Myers has been on this call. He's a good friend of mine. And he always talks about, you go to Myers with an issue, and he's like, there's no problem that a half a dozen sponsees can't cure. And that's my solution today. So again, we're walking miracles in this thing, and it's such an honor to be able to talk about my story. And I'm just very grateful that you guys would have me on here. Thank you so much.